Everything in life is somewhere else, and you get there in a car.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 540, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Sunday, February 17th, 2019. In this episode of the podcast, I will share a recording with you that I made just this morning with blogger and peak oil interested party, we'll say, Robert Brown, or Bob Brown. He's got a blog called Investing with Nature. And it was in a conversation for the Sea Realm Vault with Bob Brown that I had at the very beginning of this year that I first stated, I think, in a public forum that I think that information technology has had a bigger impact on people's lives in the past decade than has oil supply constraints or peak oil. I started the Sea Realm podcast in 2006, which was the same year that Apple introduced the first iPhone. And I think the iPhone has been a bigger deal over the past decade and change than peak oil has been. And I said that to Jim Kunstler in the most recent episode of the podcast, and you probably heard Jim's response. If not, you might want to go back and listen to it. It is Sea Realm Podcast episode number 539. The title is Extend the Pretend. So I got a fair amount of feedback, we'll say, on that episode, and some of it was quite good, and some of the better pieces of feedback that I received I read on the most recent Sea Realm Vault podcast, including pieces of an email from Bob Brown. So here is a follow-up conversation with Bob Brown, who I think understands what I'm getting at some point, but he's also fighting the good fight for the parts of the peak oil narrative which really are valuable and are worth preserving. So here is a conversation that I recorded with Bob Brown just this morning.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and I'm speaking with Bob Brown, who is a blogger, but not exactly a prolific blogger. Bob, you've been on the Sea Realm Vault podcast before, but this is your first appearance in the main, you know, the big room of the Sea Realm. If you would take a couple minutes and introduce yourself to the audience.
Okay, KMO. I'm an engineer by day. Do work that actually helps the internet, cell phone networks, and so forth. So I'm technology guy behind that. An older guy, 63, but have young kids, 18 and 22, and you know, very concerned about the future. So started listening to the Sea Realm when you were talking about the peak oil scene, and you know, just concerned about the future, where we're going, and trying to, you know, spend the rest of my life doing some things that will help help provide for a better future for my kids and other kids in the future generations.
Well, I did talk about peak oil for a very long time on the Sea Realm podcast, and then I spent several years not talking about it much. And I've been talking about it more recently, and a lot of the peak oil faithful don't like what they hear.
Oh, okay, why not? You've had some comments, I guess, recently that you feel the changes in technology have made more of a difference over the past 10 years than peak oil. And I can understand where you're coming from, and I guess I can understand a little bit why peak oil people might have their feathers ruffled by that, but what you said is true at the surface, I think.
Well, what some of the more articulate defenders of peak oil have said to me in response is that the whole technological regime which has imposed itself upon us in the past decade or so and peak oil are not unrelated spheres. I mean, there is the oil price spike of 2008, which preceded the housing crisis or the debt crisis by a few months, those were certainly connected phenomenon. And the fallout from the 2008 financial crash, the reverberations of it, we still feel today. And so the whole oil constraints and the need to control oil supplies and the need basically to salve our fears of running out of oil causes a sort of short-term thinking on the part of world leaders, including military leaders, and leads to all manner of adventurism around the world, and gives rise to the resource curse, which is the phenomenon of it being a really shitty place to live, you know, being sitting on top of oil that somebody wants, somebody powerful wants. You know, the people who benefit from it are generally not the people living on the ground above where it's extracted.
Oh, that's definitely the case. Yes, a lot has gone on about peak oil. Clearly, like the American military industrial complex, they're very aware of peak oil. And a lot of the actions that have happened this century have to do with the fact they're knowledgeable about peak oil. They understand how much U.S. life is dependent upon oil. And so they are taking actions to secure supply around the world. And yes, the people on top of the oil are not benefiting at all. They're merely pawns in a much bigger game that they have very little stake in.
I mentioned that I was a couple minutes late to our scheduled meeting here because I was reading from an article written by Charles C. Mann in Orion magazine, and a lot of people who are knowledgeable about peak oil are probably bristling just hearing the name Charles Mann. He irritated a lot of peak oil folk with this article and with, you know, his most recent book. I want to read just a few paragraphs from it to set the stage here. Charles Mann writes, "The impact of fossil fuels exhausts hyperbole. Take any variable of human well-being, longevity, nutrition, income, infant mortality, overall population, and draw a graph of its value over time. In almost every case, it skitters along at a low level for thousands of years, then rises abruptly in the 18th and 19th centuries, as humans learned to wield the trapped solar energy in coal, oil, and natural gas. In 1800, fewer than 1 billion humans walked the Earth. Most of them were hungry and poor. Just two centuries later, our numbers have increased to 7 billion. None of this was hidden from view. Educated and affluent 19th century Westerners realized that they were living in a time of unprecedented prosperity. Their 21st century descendants are richer than anything dreamed of by Solomon. Those educated and affluent Westerners also understood that all of this wealth and well-being was tied to the lavish use of fossil fuels, which is why politicians and business people have worried for more than a century about whether that petroleum would last. The world, these people knew, is finite. Its petroleum supply must surely also be finite. The apprehension came out in the open as early as 1886, when Pennsylvania state geologist J.P. Leslie declared in a widely publicized speech that the state's, quote, amazing exhibition of oil and gas was a temporary and vanishing phenomenon, close quote. Quote, there is a limited amount of oil, he proclaimed. Our children will merely, and with difficulty, drain the dregs, close quote. One of the first and most enduring products of the age of fossil fuels was the fear that the age would rapidly end. Today, this idea is generally called peak oil, after the idea that global petroleum output will soon peak, then fall. Coursing through history in a series of panics, the conviction that civilization was hurtling toward an inescapable petroleum doom has, since Leslie, become embedded in Western culture. Time after time, decade after decade, presidents, prime ministers, and politicians of every stripe have predicted that the world will soon run out of petroleum. Time after time, decade after decade, new supplies have been found and oil reserves extended. The scarcity proved to have been only the easy oil whose location was already known. People forgot their fears until the next wave of alarm, the next prophecies of catastrophe. None of this would matter, perhaps, if peak oil panics came without a cost, but that is not the case. Fear of peak oil has been a malign presence on the international stage for more than a century, driving imperialist forays, stoking hatred among nations, fueling wars and rebellion. It has cost countless lives. Equally problematic, peak oil helped establish a set of wholly mistaken beliefs about natural systems, beliefs that have repeatedly impeded environmental progress. It laid out a narrative that has led ecological activists astray for years. Far too often, we have been told we are facing crises of scarcity when the deepest of our problems are due to abundance." I will stop there, but basically Charles Mann saying there, Look, these peak oil fears, not only are they nothing new, but they're very harmful, and they have caused uncalculable harm over the past couple of centuries. All of the military adventures that the major powers got into based on the fear that they would soon run out of oil.
Yeah, there's no denying we live on a finite planet. Now, you can say peak oil, and I kind of hate the term peak oil, because it really is, okay, peak oil is when you've used up half the oil, and then in theory your production goes down during the second half, production declines, but you can have a very, very long plateau of consistent production at or in around that peak. But there's no denying, okay, we have a finite planet. Yes, in the past, we seem to have always found another source for oil. When the United States hits its original peak of conventional oil back in the 70s, yes, we got another source of oil, which was in the Middle East. So, we took our economic lumps back in the 70s, but we managed to muddle on and keep going and find new sources of oil. We imported it. So yes, we've worked around the problem for a long time, and we probably can continue to work around the problem for a long time, but at some point, oil is going to run out, and it is the most energy-dense fuel that is possible on this Earth, and at the rate we use it, it is going to have an impact on our lifestyle. Everything we do, as he points out, and that's very accurate, everything we do involves oil. All our technology, everything is based upon oil. Diesel fuel, especially derived from oil, forms the backbone of our society. And you know, in the United States is a country built on cheap oil. So I think it's just something we you can dodge it and say, okay, we avoided the worst consequences of it this time and so forth. But in the end, we have to deal with it at some point as a society. It may not be in my lifetime, may not be in yours, but at some point, future generations are going to deal with the fact that oil is not abundant.
What I said in our last conversation was that over the past decade, when I was part of which I was very focused on peak oil, and not really paying attention to trends in information technology, what happened was that social media and ubiquitous computing, ubiquitous mobile computing, in the form of smartphones right now, I think that interface will probably change shortly, but that has had a far greater impact on the daily experience of most people. That's had a bigger impact than petroleum, you know, supply constraints have had, which is a fairly, it is a very fenced in, you know, a very finite claim that I'm making. And I think people who object to it push my claim further along, you know, the continuum into something really extreme, to the point where, you know, I was told recently that, you know, my rejection of peak oil sounds like I'm saying that oil plays no explanatory role whatsoever in analyzing geopolitics, which is crazy. I mean, obviously it does. Obviously, you know, the powers get up to all kinds of nasty business in the, you know, under the banner of securing oil supplies. So, you know, my claim, I think, is pretty well defined in its scope. It's not nearly as big as I think a lot of people are taking it to be, but I stand by it. I mean, I think that in terms of the daily experience of most people, it is not petroleum supply constraints which have cause the biggest changes in their experience. And, you know, whenever we talk about peak oil and supply constraints, people bring up the 1970s oil crisis. But the 1970s oil crisis was the result of a bunch of oil producing countries forming an organization called OPEC and then embargoing oil, basically just to, you know, to punish the West and to show the United States the limitations on its power. And it worked. And that was not a result of peak oil. That was not a result of the exhaustion of the supply. That was a completely in-the-moment geopolitical phenomenon. And no reference to peak oil is required in order to make sense of it. Or at least, you know, that's a claim I will put on the table for the purposes of discussion.
Okay. Okay. Let's take your last point first. The 1970s were, I think, a function of U.S. peak oil peaking. We had been an oil exporter. When oil first became a popular fuel, we were the dominant producer in the world. We went from an exporter to an importer, and that gave OPEC the power to do what they did. Without us peaking on our oil production and continually increasing our use of oil, OPEC could not have done what they did. So it is related to peak oil, but I understand what you're saying. Certainly OPEC, yes, once they had a stranglehold now, we were dependent on them. They leveraged that power, and that caused some great disruptions. And on the first point, IT technology, yes. In everyday life, the average person has much more exposure to their smartphone and all the various apps, Facebook and so forth, then they've had to deal with anything in their life changing because the availability of oil for the past 10, 12 years. I would agree with that. I think some of the things that we've seen in the economy over the past 10 to 12 years have been a function of cheap oil no longer being available, and some ripple effects through that. So it's kind of like that's been behind the scenes of a little of some of the economic ripples we've had, and people have had to deal with that. But directly, yes, they're using their smartphones all the time. They're not standing on gas lines what people did in the 70s. So I agree with what you are saying, and I also understand from the point of view of somebody doing a podcast, maybe that would have been far more interesting than droning on about peak oil for the last 10 years.
Well, my regrets are not, becoming educated on geology or the geopolitics of oil. I mean, that is to my benefit, I think. But when I was first learning about peak oil, it was definitely infused with an air of conspiracy theory and paranoia and doomsaying, which I think, a lot of the people who were the articulators of the peak oil message, they weren't focused on that. But without the conspiratorial doomsaying aspect of it, there is no peak oil community to listen to what those people have to say. The people who are strictly interested in geology and who are not captivated by a vision of a fast collapse, it just doesn't make a big enough audience to fill a room, really. Or, if the room is filled, it's because people are, it's a university, it's an arranged talk, and instructors and professors have gathered their students and said, come listen to this speaker. I mean, I was drafted into as an audience member into many such things, not on the topic of oil, but in philosophy when I was in grad school. And so somebody wrote to me recently and they said that they had attended such a lecture. And I wish I had the email up in front of me so I could read it, but I'll just have to summarize. They said that this person basically gave the basic peak oil message, the speaker did, and including the consequences of not being able to sustain the style of life that petroleum makes possible. But he did it in such a dry and academic style that nobody interpreted it. Nobody in the audience interpreted it as being exciting enough to look up from their phones, basically. They just sat there and scrolled through social media on their phones while this guy talked about peak oil. And then at the end, when it was clear that the talk was over, everybody put their phones down long enough to clap. But unless you really play up the doomsday angle of peak oil, it doesn't captivate the interest of enough people to really generate much of a public conversation.
Yes, that's certainly true. And I think it's true of any issue. I mean, whether it's a religious evangelist, they're always trying to play up immediate doom in some form, get your reaction. Otherwise, people don't react. It's the person who's overweight and out of shape, and the doctor tells them, if you don't stop this in 30 years, you'll get a heart attack.
Yeah.
And you'll die. It may not get any kind of reaction from the guy. Very, very few people will because of that, start taking better care of themselves. They have to immediately have the problem. If you know, the doctor has to say, you're going to die tomorrow if you don't change. And in some cases, you still won't get any reaction, you know, but yeah, that's standard evangelical process. You gotta to get people's attention, and it works. You know, that's what is done in any forum where you're trying to get people to change. Is you gotta stress the immediacy, which is unfortunate because when oil peaked to $140 a barrel, that got people's attention, and by saying that we're facing immediate doom and so forth, and it doesn't happen, you then immediately lose their attention and you're discredited. So, I perfectly understand, you know, the purely academic talk, not getting people's attention. It's a very fine line. I think the approach peak oil people should take is, and not even peak oil, finite earth people, people who are concerned about the environment, concerned about future generations. You know, if our society ran on the basis like a Native American society where you thought seven generations ahead, how would you live? And say, okay, here's alternatives, and here's some alternatives better than what you are doing now, and gradually try to change the way people are living. You know, lead them towards something better rather than trying to steer them away from doom, because that just doesn't work.
I'm looking at an email that you sent to me, and I'm going to read one short paragraph and then the first sentence of the next, and then ask you to continue from there. I'm not reading, but, you know, just summarizing the thoughts. You wrote that we live on a finite planet is something that we must come to terms with for future generations to survive. But the arrival of peak oil in 2005 and 2006 just meant that we'd used up one half of the oil available in a bit over 100 years. There is still half of the oil left. The fact that rising demand and flat supply caused a spike in oil prices gave the peak oil people their 15 minutes of fame, which they used to cry imminent collapse. I do think we have seen two major steps down due to resource constraints during my lifetime. And let me stop there and let you talk about those two significant steps down due to resource constraints.
Okay. I mean, the first one we've talked about quite a bit already, but that's in the 70s. U.S. hit its peak conventional oil production in the early 70s. At that point, OPEC got a stranglehold on the oil world oil market, and they used it to basically hit us with a couple of embargoes. We faced long gas lines. Prices of gasoline doubled once, then twice over that decade. And the U.S. had a major recession in the early 70s. Struggle along. We hit, high inflation. Money lost 75% of its value, or the dollar, I should say, lost 75% of its value between 1967 and 1982. So we had a lot of economic impact from that. And obviously, we put OPEC in a position of strength where they could play games like that with the oil market. So I think we hit that back then. In the 2000s, again, we hit that $140 a barrel oil. Okay, that caused a lot of economic problems, which had rippled through society. We, in response to that, interest rates were cut. Interest rates eventually, you know, went negative in Europe and Japan, which is absolutely insane. What's been happening now over the past 10 years, I don't think we've ever recovered from the economic impact of that. We've expanded the amount of debt we have in society, and by forcing interest rates really low, we've basically put all the pension funds in the world, which were already underfunded, now they're way underfunded. They can't generate the income they need with interest rates so low. So we've it's rippled through and caused a bunch of problems. I think we're still dealing with the problems from 2008 onward, and we will have some ramifications from those hit us again over time. How they'll be, attempted to paper over and so forth. But basically, a lot of people have been promised pensions, Social Security, Medicare, and so forth that in some form is going to get defaulted on. And that's going to still be with us, I think, into the future. So I think it has had some serious ripples, but it hits us in other ways than gas lines at this point. So a little different outcome.
You mentioned interest rates repeatedly. Would you just say a little bit more about the connection between oil and interest rates?
Well, one of the things that the low interest rates have enabled is the fracking boom. Oil from fracking is not necessarily economical. You get a lot of different reports on that, but it is very, very expensive to produce. It is quick to set up and quick to get started, much quicker than drilling, say, a deep sea oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. Because it's on land, you can set it up very quickly. You can get it going very quickly. And it also depletes very quickly. A couple of years, basically, that wells run dry, where conventional oil wells ran for decades without depleting. But the fracking boom, because interest rates have gotten so low, you have money managers managing pensions and so forth who have to get an interest rate, otherwise lose their job. So they will put money into junk bonds. A lot of the junk bond space is going to companies that do fracking. So they're able to set up a company by borrowing money very cheaply, because people have, money managers have nowhere else to get any income from. So they go to these junk bond space. The cheap money has enabled companies to do fracking and so forth, not necessarily making any money or having any promise of making money. People are drawing nice salaries, making a living in the meantime. So it just continues on. But without the low, low interest rates that came about as a result of the financial crisis, fracking might not be possible. There's just so much input cost into that. That is very, very hard for them to really make money at all. And most of them are not making money. They have no cash flow. But as long as they can keep borrowing money, that keeps them going. And so basically, it's kind of like a Ponzi scheme almost, a lot of the fracking companies.
Sort of. I mean, a Ponzi scheme is dependent upon new people coming in who don't understand the dynamic. And I think that what's happening with interest rates and with fracking and with federal government policy toward, you know, energy production is more like the military. You know, the peak oil logic about horizontal drilling and fracking not being economical, you know, not being performed at a profit, but at a continual loss, that this is going to lead to its downfall. You know, the U.S. military doesn't pay for itself. It doesn't operate in the black. It is definitely an expense. It is something that we collectively, or our leaders anyway, have decided is necessary for the continuation of our way of life. And so they devote enormous resources to this thing, which is considered to be necessary to our way of life. And it's pretty clear to everybody, I think, that petroleum and the energy that we get from it is necessary for the continuation of our way of life. And even if it isn't profitable, we will still do what is necessary to keep it going.
Okay, yeah, that's a very good point and a very good analogy. I think in some sense that's true. I'm not being an expert in the area, but I know that the oil you get from fracking has limited uses. It's a very low viscosity oil. It doesn't have as much energy as conventional oil and must be mixed with a heavier grade of oil in order to be used. So I don't know how much of a real impact it has on our energy supply.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
Hello?
Hello. Did we lose?
Yes.
We did. Okay.
So the last thing I heard you say, you were talking about how fracked oil is lighter and sweeter than conventional crude, which leads to a different mixture of products, you know, petroleum-derived products that come from it.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. You get a different mixture of products coming from it, not the same amount of barrel for barrel. It is not equivalent in terms of its energy content to standard oil. So, I wonder how viable fracked oil would be on it, standing on its own without conventional oil to back up the production. So I'm quite confused as to puzzled as to, you know, where it really fits. Are we actually producing this oil, or is it just a game where these companies are getting money from the financial markets to exist, or are they actually producing, you know, a substantial amount of net energy? It's hard to really get a take, and you get strong opinions on both sides of that from supposed experts. So I'm certainly not an expert there, and I don't have a bird's eye view on it.
When did you first become interested in the topic of peak oil?
Me, probably in the, 2005, 2006 or so. I actually came about it because I was looking, you know, saving for retirement and trying to invest and looking at, okay, where do I invest? What's safe? Clearly, we had the tech crack up in the early 2000s, and I could see, okay, we're going to have some other financial problem. So I was looking at it more from a financial viewpoint, and how to save and how to avoid getting wiped out in a big downdraft, which I could see coming. And listening to financial podcasts, they started talking about, you know, peak oil and oil problems and resource scarcity and so forth. And I was always somewhat out of an environmentalist, and that caught my attention. And so I started following that and saying, you know, that is definitely an issue going forward for investing. And then how do I work around that? You know, I ended up investing in some energy companies in my retirement plans and doing fairly well on that. And fortunately, avoiding most of the 2008 financial crisis that, you know, really hit a lot of people hard. And then, you know, being environmentally oriented anyway, and then my daughter went to the College of Environmental Science and Forestry. She just graduated. So, you know, having liking the outdoors, having an environmental outlook, it got me more involved, you know, more thinking about peak oil and thinking about, okay, you know, what can we do going forward? How in some small way can I help the cause of, us living on a finite planet and coming to terms with that, you know, for future generations.
What are your impressions now of the peak oil community, you know, as you encountered it when you first started to investigate the topic?
Oh, okay. It's definitely lost a lot of traction. One thing that was big and is really big in probably 2008, 2009, I think, is the transition movement. And we were at a permaculture meeting a while ago, and somebody mentioned, yeah, well, I remember the transition town movements. You don't hear much from them anymore. So I think it got its a lot of attention when we had the oil price spike and the financial crisis, but it's lost momentum now at this point. And people are scrambling to gain it back, but I don't see anything right now that's capturing most people's attention to get them to listen.
I remember in 2011, I went to the ASPO conference in Washington, D.C., and they had a big auditorium, and people would speak before, you know, the big crowd. And we had some really good talks there. I mean, Richard Heinberg gave a talk. William Catton was there, gave a talk. But then they would break up into smaller groups, and you'd have simultaneous presentations in different rooms. And that's where you could really see the factions in peak oil community. Because, you know, if there's a choice between listening to Chris Martinson speak about investment opportunities made possible by peak oil, you know, the composition of the people in that room is going to be clearly different from the room next door where Dmitry Orlov is talking about the collapse of the Soviet Union and how the United States is hot on its heels. You know, it's very different groups of people. So there was definitely a survivalist contingent in the peak oil movement. There was definitely a, hey, this is a huge investment opportunity, let's make some money contingent in the peak oil movement. And then there was a conspiracy-oriented mindset that I saw in evidence quite a bit that basically ran along these lines. The government knows. They know we're about to run out of oil, and they're not saying anything about it. And you know, they're just making plans to cut most of us loose and leave us to our own devices while they escape into their, you know, apocalypse bunkers. And we had just passed, you know, the turnover of the millennium, and there was a millennial sort of fever in the air, and Y2K didn't come to pass. And, you know, the Mayan calendar thing wasn't looking like it was going to pan out. And there just seemed to be a hunger for some world, you know, transition narrative, and peak oil provided it for a while. But as you say, it seems to have lost its grasp on a lot of people's imaginations.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I haven't been to one of those conferences. Most of those things I hear about from people like yourself. But yes, I can definitely see the fractions. There's always a group of people that want to have conspiracy theories, and yes, the financial, aspect is always, okay, how can I make money off of this is always there. So yes, I can totally understand where you're coming from and how things would break up into groups like that.
Immediately after that event, I went to Michigan for another event that was largely peak oil themed, but with much more of an environmentalist feel to it or emphasis on it. And when you get the environmental emphasis, you also, a misanthropy comes out and really presents itself. So Guy McPherson was there. He was one of the presenting speakers at this conference that I went to. And, you know, he was not on his near-term human extinction, you know, narrative yet. He was still on peak oil, and he was insisting that, you know, the economy would collapse within 5 years because of peak oil. And when it didn't, he just moved on to a different form of doomerism, you know, didn't miss a beat. He just said, you know, it's still all going to collapse pretty soon. He just has a different reason for it now. And I remember the organizer of the event, you know, in his opening remarks, he mentioned that he had made some investment decisions that, you know, as long as the price of oil was going up, he was going to be making money. And then it immediately plunged, you know, so he had lost a bunch of money on that. And I just remember, you know, sort of muttering under my breath, well, you know, don't engage in financial speculation, and that won't happen. You know, if you treat this as an investment opportunity, or if you think that there is some secret to the universe which is being kept by the powers that be, and if you're discovering it, you know, unlocks magical financial powers. I mean, that's just, that is the sort of magical thinking that I often hear invoked and derided by peak oil people who are, you know, mocking people who think that there might be technological innovative solutions to our dilemma.
Yeah, it's funny, the end of the world projections. I think John Michael Greer ran a whole year of blogs about different end of the world scenarios that have come and gone over time, and they just keep coming up. And yes, now I think 2030 is supposed to be the end of the world. For various different reasons. I don't think peak oil is big amongst them, but climate change has been, you know, one of those things at the forefront for some of these predictions that go about, you know, a little more than a decade ahead of us.
I think the apocalyptic folk have mostly latched on to the notion of thawing methane clathrates having a rapid impact on global warming.
Yes, yes, the methane issue, which I think to some extent is real, although I guess methane dissipates in the atmosphere much more quickly than CO2. So it's, you know, more of a transient event that may not have the same long-term impact. But the apocalyptic crowd, there's always somebody there who's pushing that angle. To me, I look at it more from a long-term environmental view that, okay, we're on a finite planet. How do we come to deal with that and come to terms with that so that we can live reasonably in reasonable prosperity without constantly destroying the planet? I just finished reading the book Limits to Growth, which I had never gotten to, but, you know, very, very interesting. And, you know, that's dated from the early 1970s. And, you know, they did some computer modeling and so forth. And, you know, population growth, increasing pollution, resource scarcity, and all resources, not just oil, all have an impact on, you know, the future of human civilization on this planet. And they didn't claim to make predictions, but they kind of insinuated that, hey, before the year 2100, we could likely see a population explosion and crash and in human population. So not a great scenario, and it is something that we do have to come to terms with. And, you know, I think focusing more on possible solutions and things, not even solutions, but things to make us live with within the resources of the planet are where we should be looking going forward. And not focusing on doom. I think even if we have this population crash that they're predicting, there'll be humans on the planet in 2100 and beyond. It's just maybe quite a bit fewer.
Yeah, I don't think we are looking at the potential near-term extinction of the human species. I think what we're looking at is the near-term destruction of global industrial civilization. And the two are quite distinct.
Yes, yes, very, very, very different. And I think actually the thing that is going to hit us hardest initially is more financial. It's indirect. It finance represents real stuff, you know, the things that come from the earth. But indirectly, I think most people are going to feel the problems that we get going forward as financial, as they have been for the last 10, 12 years. People who are formerly middle classes, as we've discussed, are going towards lower middle class very quickly. And, you know, it's that collapse scenario, but it's the slow draining collapse that can be blamed on the individual person rather than things that are happening all around them in society and the way we are living.
You know, you can take a camera to certain places in the world today and, you know, a film or a video camera and take lots of video, and you could send that back in time. I mean, if you could send things back in time as proof that, you know, the end is near, that in 2019, people will be living in abject poverty and desperation. And that would be true. But you could also take that camera to many other places in the world and, you know, take some very utopian futuristic footage and say, hey, look, this is how people are going to be living in 2019. And it would look great. And I think that's largely been the case, you know, for the entirety of human experience, you know, at least since the Industrial Revolution. And I think it will continue to be the case. It's just, yeah, the proportions are going to change. There are going to be a lot more people, you know, living in abject poverty, and a lot fewer people living the utopian techno, you know, grandiose life. But that doesn't mean that the technological innovation and the progression of the advancement of certain technologies is going to come to a halt. I don't think it will come to a halt. I think most people can be living in abject poverty and that the processes that the techno-utopians like to highlight will still be ongoing. You know, even though there's talk of Moore's Law coming to an end, as far as I can tell, computers are still getting more powerful and cheaper year after year.
Yeah, well, Moore's Law is kind of hitting its limits to hit on that point. But what we've done is put more and more processor cores on each, within each package. So we're expanding computing power in a different way. So yeah, we're getting very close, or we have hit the limits to shrinking the size of a transistor, which is the atomic element of our computers. But we keep putting more and more transistors on chips, and computers are still getting a little more powerful each year. As far as, where are we going in the future? And I think there's a lot of interesting future scenarios. You got me reading the Mandevilles, or listening to it, I should say, after your talk with James Howard Kunstler. And of course, I've read some of his work on, possible future scenarios and so forth. One scenario in your interview with Jim, hit the point you talked about, yes, we're going to continue technological progress, but it's going to go to fewer and fewer people. And one future scenario that I don't think maybe gets enough credit is the Hunger Games scenario, where basically you have a handful of elite people and the rest of the country living in abject poverty, where automating stuff doesn't make any sense because the people are throwaways.
Yeah,
digging the coal and so forth. And I think, that's not an unlikely scenario. The only limit that you run into there is that some of our technology only becomes doable because it's in widespread enough use that it forces economies of scale to make it usable for everybody. So, 50 years ago, no matter how rich you were, you couldn't have an iPhone. It just was beyond the technological scope. And it's only recently that, things have become cheap enough to make a pervasive network workable to have your smartphone talk to and so forth. So you'll always run into factors of scale that maybe just make things workable that wouldn't be workable for a very small elite. But it may well be that we have a future where a handful of people have the technology. Some people, maybe like myself, could live quite well working and providing that technology for them. And then most of the rest of the world is poor. Dirt poor. I mean, and in some ways we have that now with people in Western Europe, the United States, living very, very well. And, most of rural India, rural China, and so forth, they're extremely, poor. Africa, so maybe we do have that at present, even. And it will just get, the elite will become more and more narrow.
And that seems to be the major power of information technology, is to concentrate wealth.
Yeah, definitely. You had somebody on, and I wish I could recall the name, probably 6 months ago or so.
Maybe a little longer. But go ahead.
But he made some very good points. I think he was a technology guy like myself, and he talked about people working above the API and below the API. And for example, an Uber driver is below the API. Some workers at Amazon are below the API, where basically they're getting their directions from a computer. They're isolated from their peers, so they have no power of numbers. And the technology is being used to keep them separate, isolated, and powerless, and working at, very much slave wages. So, I thought that was an excellent interview. And yes, it highlighted what you're saying now, is that, IT is used to concentrate wealth in a lot of cases.
The above and below the API line, I recognize, but I can't recall who I was talking to about that.
Yeah, I wish I could recall and give him credit, because it was that was a very, very good interview, I thought. what you're saying is very true, that IT is now given a lot, concentrated a lot of power in the hands of a handful of people. And the only people who are benefiting is maybe people like me who can help create that technology and make it work. But other than that, the other middle-class people are getting the bad end of that. They're not doing well in those cases.
Now, I think the techno elite would say, hey, look, you know, the Silicon Valley folks are giving away all of these really amazing services. And certainly your life is enriched by free Gmail and Wikipedia and podcasts, you know, and YouTube. And you use this stuff all day. You must like it. So, you know, you can't complain. You're getting something pretty good out of it. And yeah, maybe, you know, you don't have a one income household like you used to. Maybe you've got a three income household and you're looking to take in boarders. You're looking for some other source of income, or, you know, you're looking to take a third job or something, but you got a great smartphone. I mean, the power packed into that little device is really amazing. It's more than NASA had when they sent people to the moon.
It is absolutely amazing what we're able to do, and it enables some wonderful things. And I think, you know, what you're doing, podcasting, is a wonderful thing. You would have broken into major media years ago and been very successful that way. And certainly you have the ability to do that. But now it allows you to talk about what you want to talk about and gives you an opportunity to reach an audience that is interested in that. That may not be enough mainstream to have a TV show or a radio show about, you know, syndicated nationally. Of course, I'm talking at large scale, but so it gives a lot of capabilities. I mean, you have online teaching tools, again, a lot of great capabilities that we didn't have before. But I almost think for most people, it is no different than being dealt drugs. And yeah, they're addicted to these things. They don't push away and escape from them, but it's become this other world that they live in, away from the real world, and kind of, you know, just keeps them preoccupied and keeps them busy, and, you know, avoids the reality that they're living in. So, yeah, it's, I think, hurt most people for the most part, although every innovation is a two-edged sword. It can be used for good, and it can be a negative for society.
We're just about out of time, but I got an email from a listener who's, I think, probably near the same age as you and has worked in electronics since he was 19 years old. And he has some strong reservations about, you know, where the technology is taking us. I just want to read one paragraph from his email. He writes, "Over the last 20 years or so, I've become obsessively interested in the negative social effects of technological innovation. They are so serious that I've been heard to say that if computers and the internet went away, I'd celebrate. After all, I was around when there were almost no TV, few dial phones, answering machines, computers, cell phones. My initial foray into electronics was to learn enough about the field to take an FCC test, thereby earning an amateur radio license. That enabled me to talk to people around the world with equipment I put together myself from what I earned mowing lawns and babysitting. It's hard to explain to a contemporary 20-year-old how very adequate life was then without all the present-day electronic accoutrements. It's only after the last 15 or 20 years of observing the burdensome parade of technical innovation and its effect on me and all of us that I could fully understand that myself."
Yeah, okay. You forwarded that email to me, and I just got to read it before we started talking. And yeah, very well written and excellent. And there's a lot more to it than the paragraph you read.
Yeah. But that's what I wanted to end on. Just that I look at the life that my children are living, you know, with their devices, and the life that I lived when I was their age, you know, either out in the world on my bicycle or a little later behind the wheel of a car. But my youth was a lot more interesting and a lot more dynamic in terms of the adventures that I was able to have in the real world than I think theirs is, and their adventures in the simulated world.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, most of the simulated world is a wasteland, kind of like TV became. you know, you had 100 channels of nothing to watch, but it was an excuse for you to sit on the couch and not participate in the outside world. And yes, definitely getting out on a bicycle and riding around, that's I think a much better youth for people. And unfortunately, I think in the long run, most people are going to be forced back to that type of youth against their will. And our society has definitely been hurt by a lot of the technological innovations. I know I was in at the YMCA in the gym, and they had a short story there, and they said the average man's waist now has exceeded 40 inches, where it was, 35, 36 inches back when I was younger, in 1970 or whatever they use for a comparison. And yeah, it's done a lot of harm. And in a lot of ways, it's acted like a drug that people use to stop not be participating in the world. And, they're going to end up, future generations will end up participating in the world in one way or the other. I just hope it's a lot less harsh than it might potentially be.
Well, I have to chuckle. I think my waist size is 38 right now, so I'm just south of 40 inches, and I can be maybe I can wear that as a badge of pride that I'm I have a smaller waist than the average male. I'm taller than the average male, so I think I have a little bit more allowance around the waist. But I'm not starving, and I don't see myself being in danger of starving anytime soon. And in fact, I spend a lot more time and energy trying to keep my waist size down than trying to find enough to sustain my body for the next few hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a battle when you have such abundance of food around you, and not necessarily good quality food too, which is the other aspect of the food we're getting now.
Exactly. That is a deep subject and one that we don't have time to delve into, but let me give you the opportunity to basically provide a summary of what you think is important in this conversation and what you wanted to communicate.
Okay. Basically what I wanted to communicate is that, peak oil, I'd hate to use, I don't like to use that term, but we live on a finite earth, and we should start to make adjustments to living on that finite earth, so that future generations will have good world in which to live. Things that I think you should be doing, a lot of the appropriate technologies, items that they would attack, insulation and so forth in homes, makes a huge, huge difference in your life. You'll save a lot of money, which is always nice. That I think is one thing everybody should be addressing in around the world, and especially in this country where we waste a lot of energy. Other thing I'm very into, and I think is a really useful tool for moving forward, is permaculture, where design things with nature in mind. A lot of it is about growing your own stuff, and as we talked about, the quality of food is terrible these days, but if you can grow your own food, you can get food of much higher quality, and it is much healthier for you. And a quick plug, in Northwest Connecticut, we've put together a small permaculture community, in the Northwest Connecticut permaculture community, and anybody who is in the area, please, if you're interested, get in touch with me by my blog, Investing with Nature, which, as you point out, is a skimpy blog. I'm more of an engineer who occasionally blogs than a blogger. And that's about it.
Well, we live in a technological civilization. We need engineers.
Yeah, I'm glad about that, and I love the work. But I do see the downside of what I'm doing too, and it makes me feel a little guilty. And I'm glad to be able to talk about some other things that are, I think, more positive and get people involved in the real world.
Well, that's a good place to end it. Again, the blog is
investingwithnature.com.
All righty. Bob Brown, thanks so much. I look forward to our next conversation.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. Your mind, one week at a time.
That brings us to the end of another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. For those of you who subscribe to The Vault, thank you very much for that. For anybody who has supported the Sea Realm Project in any way, thank you very much. I do have regrets about the degree to which I bought into the more extreme and sensationalist and provocative versions of the Peak Oil story, but I certainly can't regret being put in touch with the Sea Realm Podcast audience. You're a good group of people to be connected to. Thanks so much. I will talk to you again soon. Please, stay well.